Thank you for joining us on this episode of Eminent Teachnology with Dr. Rochelle Newton and Drew Stennett, where we examine current and emerging technologies through the lens of diversity and equality.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to a new episode of Eminent Teachnology with Dr. Rochelle Newton and Drew Stennett. Today, we are going to be talking about what's new in technology, and there's a lot of cool new stuff in here that I'm excited to talk with you about, Rochelle. I can't talk today. In my mind, I'm thinking, oh, I've done this intro so many times, I can say it like the back of my hand, and then as soon as I turn off my brain, my words go funky. But new technology is what we'll be talking about today. So, Rochelle, what are you thinking about for some new technology topics?
There's so many, out there. And one of the things that was really interesting to me was Facebook's parent company changed their name to Meta. Mm-hmm. And then there was all of this stuff about the metaverse. And, it was kind of like, are they the same thing? What is one versus the other? And then it came to me, metaverse, whatever that term might mean, means more, whereas Meta means just Facebook and their companies, Instagram and whatever else they own. Am I correct about that?
So a little bit. So when I think of the metaverse, I think of, well, it's a good question. So when we say Facebook, Facebook is more or less a product that the company Meta makes. But like you said, they also make Instagram. Or they bought Instagram and own Instagram, but they run it. The new Threads app is a new app that they launched under that.
I just joined it because I had deleted my Twitter account when Elon Musk took over. So happy to have something else.
Sorry. Yes. Yes. No, I just deleted my, I have not deleted my account, but I've taken Twitter off of my phone as of this morning. It's just Twitter's turned into awful, awful.
It's awful.
But I do like Threads, although sort of side tangent, I was talking with Threads to my brother, and we were both like, it looks really like clean and like it's so nice in there. And like, how did they do this? And then he pointed out, well, they just don't have ads on there yet. Like, it's all ad free.
Yeah. But they're coming. Believe me, they're coming.
Yes. 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 Exactly.
So the metaverse, the language of the metaverse, so Forbes, CNBC, all of them did articles about the metaverse and what it means and largely what they said. It was just a big internet. But talk to us about how you see metaverse and what does it mean going forward? What does it mean to the consumer? What does it mean to organizations? What is the metaverse and what does it impact as we go forward?
So I think of the actual metaverse as, one of the things that Facebook purchased is a thing called the Oculus Rift, which is a VR headset that a very popular VR headset. I mean, it may be the best VR headset. I'm not super familiar with what's top of the line VR now. But in my understanding, at least, what they want the metaverse to be is this place where instead of opening up your web browser and seeing your friends' messages on Facebook.com, you would pop this headset on and go interact with people in a completely VR way. And gaming may be involved in that, but it's not necessarily required. I think a lot of VR right now focuses on gaming, because it's sort of it adds a new dimension to gaming, which can be fun for a lot of people, I think. But there's probably not a ton of money to be made off of that versus the metaverse or this VR universe where if you think about Instagram ads, think of the ads they could put in VR, right? You're walking around a city and there can be an infinite number of billboards advertising things to you in this fake world. But it won't just be advertisements. There will be personal connections and being able to actually talk to people in this VR world. I've never personally used it, but it sounds sort of cool. But at the same time, all of your information is going to be mined while using something like that. And, now that you have this headset on, it's not only if you think of about a website and how they track clicks and track visits and everything, that's pretty primitive and already very accurate. Think about the targeted ads you get just from clicking on things. Well, now think about the ads you're going to get when Facebook or Meta can literally track what your eyes are looking at through a session. So, if you're looking at this donut billboard for two extra seconds versus a milk billboard, well, you're going to be getting some donut ads without even having to click at anything. Just, you know, maybe your eye lingering over it generates enough data for them to send you a new ad.
You tell us what VR is.
So VR is virtual reality. It's an immersive way to interact with a digital environment. It's a sort of cool technology that's been around for a while, but it's one of those that keeps getting better and better. You put on a headset. The headset can look sort of like goggles, but what it actually is a dedicated screen for your left eye and a dedicated screen for your right eye, and it puts up digital images in sync with each other so that what you're looking at actually looks three-dimensional. And not three-dimensional as in, like, you know, a 3D game that you're playing on your computer that you can obviously see, like, you know, it's all behind your screen. It's not popping out. Because they have a dedicated screen for each eye, it literally tricks your brain into thinking that there are objects in the physical world that you could reach out and touch. I mean, you can't touch them because they don't actually exist there. But the graphics are good enough for your brain to think that they're actually real. And that's, like, it makes me sort of woozy even thinking about it, but it works, like, pretty well.
Yeah. So we, at the law school, we bought, when they first came out, we bought the headset. It mm-hmm. was amazing. And what's the place, the, let me change their name, the technology place this over in, I think it used to be in, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
So they got a bunch of headsets. And so they were using organizationally as teaching tools, right? So mm-hmm. kids could actually go and be in Europe or go be with the Pope or go, you know, wherever, that you could go to all these places using this virtual reality headset. And a lot of people, you know, went right for it. And I have to mention, at the same time, Google Glass had started making some inroads in technology, you know, so there were these fun things that allowed you to see reality different than what it would be if you're physically there. Mm-hmm. So when we think about the metaverse and all these things we just talked about, is it fair to say the metaverse is just simply a huge collaborative of the internet and everything that is on it?
Yeah, and it's not the entire internet. So that's sort of the thing with metaverse right now, is it is sort of a walled garden. At least in my understanding. So I sort of consider it like, remember AOL back in the day? Like, AOL would be a thing. You could go in and, like, talk to people in chat rooms and, you know, do all these just AOL type things. You would have your email. But it wasn't like the wild, wild west internet. Like, it was a very controlled environment. I think you could, like, get on the real internet if you wanted to, but that wasn't, like, the primary thing with AOL. AOL was mainly like, hey, here's our stuff. Remember, like, movies would even have, like, our AOL page is, you know, bigdisaster.movie or whatever. And you could see, you know, you could just go to AOL and search for these things. And I think Meta is the same way. It is all controlled by, or the metaverse is the same way. It is controlled by Facebook/Meta. I have a hard time remembering that their name isn't Facebook.
So are you saying that Facebook owns the concept of the metaverse too? I mean, this digital thing, because, like, when I read about it, it doesn't have Facebook attached to it when I read about it.
I thought it did. This is definitely something I could be mistaken about, but I thought, my understanding was Metaverse is a, like, VR world curated by Facebook. So, but I could be wrong on that. Maybe I'm definitely open to being called out there.
I don't know exactly whether that is correct or not, because you may be right. It's just that when I read about it, it's typically there's a lot out there. Sometimes they make a distinction between Meta and Metaverse, but more mm-hmm. times than not, like, I think the New York Times has an article about the Metaverse and they don't mention Facebook at all. So, yeah. I mean, that's interesting. It's very, very interesting to see where that goes in the grand scheme of things. Okay. Yes. So my second question is this. So right now, you can't get away from it. You hear about the actors and writers are on strike, you know, and they are the lifeblood of what we know as entertainment.
Oh, yeah.
One of the things that they have raised a concern about, and that is about artificial intelligence or AI. And so we talked about this not too long ago about, you know, being able to write a book or write a script using something like, ChatGPT or, you know, Kaggle or Whisper or whatever it is, you know, so there's some concerns about that. But what does this really mean, this new emerging technology like AI and things like acting and writing? Mm-hmm. Wouldn't they see that as a compliment as opposed to something that's, you know, harmful?
Yeah. So I don't think the actors and writers see it as a compliment at all. I think they are 100% against it in all forms, which is, I mostly agree with the writers and actors, but I do think they're probably taking a little bit too tough of a stand. I don't want to say too tough because, so what's happening is Hollywood wants to, I won't say replace writers, but if they have a TV show, they want to have, and let's say it's a popular TV show, and right now they need 10 writers in a writer's room to crank out episodes. They want to have a single writer crank out episodes, or, you know, maybe a single writer doing 5 shows or 6 shows or 7 shows, because writers are expensive. And honestly, they're not that expensive, but they're more money than Hollywood wants to pay, because, you know, Hollywood wants to make money, right? Unfortunately, it's a business. It's just a business that involves a lot of artists. So what Hollywood wants to do is to either have a single writer that does this stuff and then can do all of the, I think the studio would call it the boring work, and then writers would call it the actual work of filling in those holes, right? So maybe you have a creative writer think up a story, and then instead of having a team of 10 other writers in the room to flesh it out and, you know, write all the dialogue and everything like that, the Hollywood studio systems want that to be done by AI. They think, hey, if we can get one person just like writing these prompts and cranking out stories, maybe AI can do the rest as far as writing goes. The biggest downside to that is that right now there's a lot of downsides. A huge one, of course, is that people would lose their jobs and these writing jobs would disappear. People that are getting writing jobs are worried that they won't be able to sustain themselves on just writing. And in fact, like many writers can't sustain themselves on writing today. Even people that are making like hit Netflix shows, they still have to have a side career because they're just not getting paid well enough.
Exactly. But let me just interrupt just for mm-hmm. one thing. So one of the challenges that Hollywood has faced is streaming, right?
Mm-hmm.
People like me aren't inclined to go to the movies to see a movie. You know, I can watch it from home when it's released on one of the streaming services, or I can buy the DVD, but I don't have to go to the movies. And explain to us why physically going to the movies is more beneficial to Hollywood than someone watching a streaming service or purchasing a DVD, so we can understand why this issue about pay is such an important one.
So that's a great question. So back in the last writer's strike, which was around, is that like 2008 or 2009? That was just when streaming was getting popular. And the what happened was writers and actors realized, let's take a step back even further. So if you're writing on a show or acting in a show, you're going to get a paycheck for doing the show. And then in the old world, pre-streaming, you would get a much smaller paycheck every time that TV show aired on TV, right? So you would say get $5,000 to act a role, and then maybe you would get $10 every time they showed you a role in perpetuity, which seems like, to me, that seems nice. It seems pretty fair because the studios are still making money off of your work even after you act in it. So what would happen is acting and writing is not always you're not guaranteed a job for a full year or 2 years or 10 years, maybe not even more than a couple months. And because of that, actors and writers would have dry spells. And because of these residual checks, the dry spells weren't that bad because, hey, maybe you're not booking new work, but at least you can pay your bills from all of your previous work that had come in. When streaming came around, none of those residuals went into place. And in fact, it's really hard to tell how much money a movie that gets released on streaming makes. So let's think about Mission Impossible. Mission Impossible, new movie comes out, gets released in the theaters. Everybody pays $7 to go see it. you know, 100,000 people saw it. That's 100,000 times seven, you know, take out the money that it, you know, that the theater needed to actually play it. And then you get a real, like, you get a pretty solid dollar amount on how much a movie made. If you switch that to the streaming model, let's imagine like the new Mission Impossible came out on Netflix. Lots of people will probably watch it. How many people watched it? We'll just have to ask Netflix. Like, did people join Netflix just to watch this? Maybe, maybe not. Did people join to watch something else? What if Mission Impossible and the new Deadpool came out on the same day and Netflix gets 100 new subscribers? How do you know which ones joined in because of the new Deadpool and which one joined in because of the new Mission Impossible? And that sort of works to the studio's advantage because they never really have to say that a movie made a profit, right? Like, and that's sort of, that's one of the things that really like screws a lot of the actors is they'll do a job and part of their contract will be, let's say you get 5% of however much money this movie makes. Which is better than nothing, but a lot of times the studios can just like tweak that number down so small so that no movies really make money, even though they are making money. You know, they say like, oh, well, we had to use that to pay ourselves. We had to use that to promote it. And it's just the actors and writers are getting like squeezed out right now. And I think AI is sort of that, the last straw of like, how much can we squeeze out of these writers and actors? So thinking about like writers, text is very easy to generate with AI right now, as we know through ChatGPT. So that could absolutely squeeze them out. The actors are worried, and worried for a correct reason, because the studios have said this is true, is that if they, what the studios want is if an actor goes and makes a movie, they want to be able to digitize that actor and use that actor's image, likeness, everything for the rest of time without ever having to pay that actor another penny, which also seems very bad. I was just gonna say, and on top of that, we have to remember that all these AI things are very, I guess derivative is the right word, they're only creating things that they've seen in the past. So if you know, if writers do go away, we lose creativity there. And then the flip side of that is like, is all art derivative? Like, I don't know, like there's probably an argument that it is, right? Like, I don't know that, I mean, everybody's art is influenced in other people's art in some way or another. So I don't know. I feel like that means AI could get really good and could possibly get very creative, which is bad for the writing industry.
And also do artificial intelligence can generate images or likeness of people, right? That can be mm-hmm. used. So not only do you have the writing, but you also have the actor part of it. Like, so, you know, there have been some very, very good likenesses of people in, I guess, entertainment. I don't want to say mm-hmm. movies because I see them in television, you know, so there's that. So it's easy to see why the actors and the writers are concerned. But if you're the movie production company, if you own what's happening, I mean, why would you fight to keep actors? Because what you said, so ChatGPT and other of these things write what they see, but once you have created or code in them to learn themselves from what they see, so like going back to one of my other favorite movies, The Fifth Element. Mm-hmm. So in the movie, the woman is looking at some screen and she's learning all these things. What's to prevent ChatGPT and other AI tools like that to not learn themselves and to be better than what a writer is? Because really, if you take any movie, I don't care what it is, in recent memory, that the content and the idea is already done, right? Yeah. Somebody's yeah. done this 100 times. So before Mission Impossible, there was this and there was that and there was the other. So it's not like they're doing new stuff. So maybe they're being more yeah. inventive. So maybe they're driving a motorcycle off a 100-foot cliff and dropping down to, you know, or what's the other one with the dragon and that's really possible? What is it? Game of Thrones?
Yeah.
What's to prevent people from doing things like that and to not necessarily need these actors and mm-hmm. writers anymore? Because it seems like to me it would be advantageous to the movie companies to not have them, to TV programs to not have them, because they save money. Because like you said, Like Amazon, for example, I have Amazon Prime, and there are some movies I want to watch on Amazon. They charge me. I can rent it. I can buy it. So that's money making for Amazon. But does any of that money and this whole concept of replacing actors and writers apply to things like that? Do they get anything?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So like, I don't think the actors make any money off of the like Amazon rentals and streaming, which is like pretty messed up in my opinion. And like, you're right about the, like, we went to go see Mission Impossible over the weekend, and I found it sort of boring because like every one of those stunts, I've seen them, and I've already seen it before. Like, it was nothing new. And in fact, I would say the stunts in this were worse than the stuff that they were copying. Like, they just, I don't know. I was not a huge fan of the new Mission Impossible movie, but that was, to my knowledge, that was written by a real person. And I feel like they probably just didn't do a great job on that. And I think what the writers would argue is that you're always going to get a better story if it's created by a person. I don't fully buy that. I think that some writers will definitely put out better stories than what AI can generate right now, but I don't think all writers can. And in fact, like, maybe a majority of writers could probably be replaced by AI. And as AI gets better, like, this is one of those things, like, what is a new idea now? Like, has anybody had like a truly new idea?
In anything, you know, there are those that come along every once in a while, right? So we got ChatGPT, that's a new idea, right? Somebody took AI to another level, so that's a new idea. But really, it's not. You're absolutely right. There is nothing new. And I would say in terms of these movie franchises, usually the first one is the best one. By the time they get to second, third, and fourth, it's stale, you know? So Black Panther, the first Black Panther, oh my God. I mean, it's wonderful. And, you know, Wakanda is good too, but it doesn't hold a candle to Black Panther. I mean, the storyline is good in Wakanda and all that. You know, you got death and destruction, but you had death and destruction in Black Panther. So, you know, you could see how the second franchise and those that go behind it, like, what's the one with the car where
Fast and Furious?
Oh my God. I mean, how many of them have they been? And I mean, like,
11. I love Fast and Furious, though. Those, I would have been rather watching a Fast and Furious movie than the Mission Impossible. I tell you, Rochelle, those are like one of my favorite franchises of all time.
I mean, so the first one was great. The second one was the third one, what's the guy who died? You know, who I don't think he died in the acting, but he died, you know.
Oh, yeah. Paul Walker.
Yeah. Those were great. After that, you know, I got to the point where, okay, they got a new one. I'll wait till it comes on TV. I don't even want to stream. I'll just wait.
Did you make it to Fast 8? Fast 8 was peak, the fate of the Furious.
Okay, I'll go find Fast 8. But my point just is, it's like, you know, you're right. You know, so the people who are writing these things, are they really thinking through their audience, right? So you might love, like, so Black Panther. You can't help but love, you know, I can't think of his name right now. The guy who played Black Panther. So you love him.
You Chadwick Boseman.
You can't help but love him. But that said, you know, without him, the franchise isn't as good as it could be without him. And I think that when they write these stories and these things, I think that maybe there's something to be said for combining it with so you have a writer. And that writer's working with AI to create a better script, an AI that has learned to think about these things. So if you say, oh, I'm going to create a movie with a fast car and people doing dangerous stunts, so it learns what that means and it finds out what all the possibilities are. And then they write it together, which might make it more exciting.
Yeah. And I think that could definitely work. And I just feel like because of all this, like, writers aren't going to be able to make money is like the real problem to me. Like, and that just seems bad for culture. Although this also reminds me of, so you know the movie Jaws, right? Everyone loves Jaws. Like,
I do not. Scary.
It is very scary. So I understand. But, you know, it was like the first summer blockbuster, you know, this cool sea monster, you know, eating people. And it spawned out a bunch of derivative work, right? After Jaws, we got piranha, we got grizzly, we got alligator, we have all these things. And I was listening to an interview with Roger Corman, who was one of his company produced Piranha, which is like widely seen as just a ripoff of Jaws. And his argument was that Jaws actually ripped off an earlier film of his that was about a sea monster. And he's like, you know, I'm the one that thought of it, not Jaws. And yet all my, you know, movies are getting panned for being derivative of this. And then he said someone in the audience was like, well, actually, your movie was derivative of this other German sea movie. And like, they're actually the first ones that did it. And Roger Corman was like, yeah, I didn't know about that. Like, like you're probably right. Like, it just, it goes back infinitely. Like how, not, I don't want to say ripping things off, but, you know, things having an, movies or art having an influence on other art. I mean, I think all good art is influenced by other good art, to at least to some level.
Absolutely. And think about this. Jaws, you had Godzilla, same concept. Those Jurassic movies, same concept, you know, humans interacting with creatures and having a negative outcome, you know, but to be fair, right? So there's been a lot of good stuff produced by writers. I mean, television shows like MASH. I mean, the people who wrote MASH, that's exceptional. You know, they were really, really good, you know. So there are those that are good writers. But since we are so forced to integrate with technology, why not find a way to marry both, right? So like, let's just say stunts. They have a lot of stunt actors who perform the real big stunts for these people. Why couldn't that be a digitally generated image of the real person creating that stunt, and then they can go in and remove the digital face of the person and put the real person there in the lab, you know, when they come back to the party, right? So, I mean, there are lots of things to think about there. But Drew, my question is, and you touched on this a little bit earlier, so this is affecting the writers and the actors. What happens when it comes to our front door, right? So when it comes to other industries, right? So right now, there's a real attack on higher education. Like, there's so much written about, you know, you need to get rid of it. You know, you don't need to have people come to classes. And why can't we do this like we did with remote work? We have people learn remotely as opposed to coming to a building or learning digitally or whatever we create. It's coming. The question is, how do you find a way to get the best out of it for both worlds?
Yeah. And that's a question that I don't really know the answer to. I mean, I mean, you got to make yourself unique from the robots somehow, right? Like, and I think a lot of that is just advancing your own skill sets, hopefully faster than technology can keep up. But I mean, that's not reasonable for everybody. Like, not everybody is going to be able to do that.
Yeah. And you, the uniqueness of humans versus robots are what I think wins out, right? We have the ability to feel emotions. We have the ability to have some correlation between what we're seeing and is it real or do we process it? Like, you see, you know, like, I don't know if you remember this, but back in the day, I think this was when the first Bush was president, and the man who couldn't spell potato and tomato, you know, they were talking so much about children learning violence from rap songs and from watching violence on TV. You know, I think that's a cop out, but really every one of these instances, we have to find a way to find humans, and they can peacefully coexist with digital things like AI and us without losing themselves in the process, so they don't, you know, get taken over by technology. So we talk about this a lot, about, you know, so you're going to add things to your body, you can get your eyes fixed, all these things can be done with technology. The problem is how do you find the happy medium in between? And I realize that's not a simple question to ask, but I think we need to keep bringing it up for other people to think about and for us to think about what possibly can be done.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And like, it's funny, Mitch, like the feel, like we as humans are like unique in that we do have feelings, but AI is really good at, I don't want to say faking feelings, but giving the impression that it does have feelings, which seems so weird. And I think that in itself will make like for good movies in the future, as I mean, they're already releasing movies about AI becoming, you know, sentient, but it's an interesting time, I guess.
What's your little robot girl, Megan?
I mean,
that's a perfect example of something feeling, right? Because she senses something is happening to the little girl. She's decided to be protected. So there has to be something in there that drives that, right? There has to be some thinking and some emotion in there.
I mean, I don't know if that's the case. I think she just has to fake it. Like, it's not fake to her, but she is not like a living creature either. It's just the way that she was programmed, maybe not purposefully programmed to murder, but, you know, a side effect of the way that she was programmed included the ability for her to commit murder. And I would still argue that she's not actually feeling those emotions. She's just a robot that is exhibiting what someone would do if they were feeling those emotions.
It's coming, Drew. The robot is going to be feeling emotions. They're going to be upset about things that, you know, especially unplugging them or not charging them up.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
What movie is that? Hal? Is it Hal? One movie, with, you know, you had, it was.
Oh, 2001?
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. I lost my train of thought. Oh, I was just watching a video of the Boston Dynamics robot evolution, and it showed like in the early 80s when they were doing these robotics, and you know, it was more or less like a pogo stick that could sort of balance itself. And then you slowly see it like, okay, now it's two pogo sticks. Now it's two pogo sticks and a torso. And then, you know, by this year, now it's a full-on like robot jumping on trampolines, doing flips in the air. And I was like, yeah. It was like all of these just minor steps that got us from this pogo stick with a motor attached to it to this like completely independent robot that's, you know, doing gymnastics in the middle of a, you know, crowded room.
Yeah, I'm afraid for humanity, and not imminently, not right now, but I think that in time, these robots are going to outdo anything that we thought we programmed them to do because they're going to learn. I think that, you know, Star Trek and other places started pushing artificial intelligence long before it really was a thing. And here it is now. And is humanity prepared for it? This is the discussion we could have for hours and days and weeks. This is so important. Let me speak for me. I don't have the answers. All I know is that we need to keep asking the questions, because if we don't, we may find ourselves being monitored by a robot. How long have you been gone? Like your mother. How long have you been out? You know, you need to come home.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, it's just a matter of time.
Just a matter of time. Okay, Drew, we're running out of time. So let me get to one more of my questions. So I was reading something the other day. And again, goes back to metaverse, digital twin, and the Web3. Can you talk a little bit about those in the time we have left?
Yes, absolutely. So when we think Web3, and this is a really good description, this is a description that I had never heard of before seeing an article that you sent over. And it described Web1 as the read-only web. So if we jump back to the 1990s, early 2000s, you just read things on the web, right? You would have a homepage that you would look at, you know, you'd have your Yahoo stories, your, you know, your newspapers were on there. It was just very, very basic. It was like, you know, little books that you could just bring up on your computer and read through. Web 2 was more of the like social web. So they described that as read write. So now, instead of just going to my company or my local newspaper's website and reading stories, now I can comment on them. Or now I can create a community based on one of those stories in Facebook or MySpace or, you know, however many other web spaces they had out there. And that's sort of, I think we're on the end of that phase right now. Like, it's still there. Like, Facebook is still there, melting people's brains. Like, it all exists as it did. But as we approach Web 3, which they described as read, write, and own, I feel like this is very promising, but I don't know that it will come to full fruition. So read, write, and own means not just am I going to be able to go to a website and interact with it, but a couple extra things. I'm going to be able to interact with it and prove that, like, the account I'm interacting with is me, Drew Stinnett, and not someone pretending to be me. And that can be done through things like one of our favorite words, the blockchain can do that, like cryptographic signing, all of these things to prove that you're a real person. And in addition to that, federation is really becoming popular. So one of the big, we were talking about Twitter earlier, big problem with Twitter is it's a big walled garden, right? So before the Elon Musk days, I would consider them like a fairly like balanced website. You know, they would remove false information. Lots of people were on there. There were, of course, lots of trolls, but they more or less tried to keep the trolls in check. And then when Elon Musk bought it, he sort of like brought all of those people that had previously been kicked off back in and tried to promote it as a quote unquote free speech thing, which I think a lot of times free speech is a code for hate speech in some of these communities. So now like Twitter's just seems to be like bottoming out. The alternatives to that, the first of which was Mastodon, which existed before sort of the downfall of Twitter, but it's very similar to Twitter. Although you may not own, but it doesn't exist in only one place. So there's no like mastodon.com that everyone signs up in. Like if we wanted to, we could have an intimate Teachnology Mastodon server, and we just let on the people that like we know and that we trust to be able to talk on that server. However, there's a protocol for servers to talk to each other. So we could still speak to, say Dan had a Mastodon server. We could still, you know, communicate with Dan using this special, I think they call it the Activity Pub Sub protocol. But it's just this open thing that lets social networks talk to each other. And that's another sort of cool thing about Threads, although Threads has not fully implemented it, is they say they are going to implement this pub sub model where, in theory, we could have an imminent Teachnology, you know, Mastodon or whatever product ends up using that protocol and still interact with people on threads.net or whatever the actual Threads thing is. And I find that, like, in theory, that could be, like, really cool. In practice, it seems very hard to maintain. Like, how do we, you know, how do we keep, say, Threads starts getting bad users on there and we on our imminent Teachnology service don't want to interact with the bad users? Well, does that mean that we have to like totally disconnect Threads from our federation model? Like, will we like have to be back to blocking individual people on there? That sounds painful. And the algorithms for promoting posts, at least in Mastodon, and I feel like Threads as well, just aren't quite as good as Twitter is. Like in the good days of Twitter, I feel like I could go there, I would look at my front page, and I would see all of the top tweets were things that I was super interested in. And I don't see that on either Mastodon or Threads right now. Like there is information that I like in there, but it's not going to be the top five things. I sort of have to go hunt for it.
Yeah. I think these new technologies are really, you know, eye-opening and all of that. The problem is you cannot control, and this is why I think that it's so important to make the distinction between digital and human, right? So in humanity, let's just say on your Facebook page, I put a bunch of negative comments about you. Oh, Drew does not know how to play bingo, or Drew doesn't like nice movies. He doesn't like scary movies. I just put all this stuff on your page. You can go in selectively and block me. You can delete the content. There's a whole bunch of things you can do. Mm-hmm. Now, thinking of the world digitally, so now this digital presence is managing us. So Mastodon, Thread, whatever it is managing us. And it's doing the cleaning, if you will. So it's deciding what should be in there, what shouldn't be in there. You know, and I find that amazing. You know, like, so you go to certain websites and they want you to click on the images you see, and then you click this box that I'm not a robot.
Yeah.
How do you prevent a robot from doing that? You know, I mean, like, if the robot is smart enough to know of these little safeguards seem to me that are not really true safeguards, because, you know, Threads is good. It's a good alternative to Twitter, because Twitter had gone downhill, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. Now, Threads, I'm not a big social media person, so I don't spend a lot of time out there. You know, I might go out every once in a while, even for my business. I don't do the social media thing, you know, but with those things holding the promise that they do.
Yeah.
How do we digitally manage our image, our profile? How do we manage that? You know, so like, okay, it knows that I am an X year old Black female living in this place. Da, da, da. Everybody knows that. That's free. You could go anywhere and find out who I am and what I am, right?
Yes.
I was talking to someone at Durham Academy and they said, thanks for my friends at Google. I found you. That was funny. Yeah. and then send a link and I could click on to see my identity and all this stuff, you know.
Yeah.
But what's to prevent us and technology from altering who we are and then, you know, creating this false narrative about who we are? You know, yeah. There's so much frightening about this, Drew. There really is so much. So, you know, I remember Web 2.0. I didn't see the name stick, right? So every time you look, you go to the internet, it's Web 2.0.
Yeah.
What is that? You know, and so You get all these, you know, other iterations of things out there. So Web 3, digital twin. What is a digital twin? When I first read about this, I said, and why they could have thought a better name of this thing.
Yeah. So if I'm understanding right, a digital twin is like, and I think it can be applied to like people or actual like places in the world. And it makes me think of like Second Life, where people would make, let's say like the Wrigley Stadium in the digital world that was, you know, an exact replica of something like Wrigley Stadium, you know, in the digital world that you could then go walk around in and interact. And I think of digital twins as sort of the same thing. It's like yourself online, not a different character that you create, but an actual like copy of you that you are, I'll say, like honestly interacting with, as opposed to trying to make a character out of somebody or, you know, do an internet trolling thing, which I guess is very popular. But yeah, that's sort of what I see the digital twins as, is, you know, this copy of real life things, but moved over into the digital world. And it makes things, I hope that ends up being a good thing, because that could bring people together that are, you know, like far apart in the world. And so instead of us having to interact on a Zoom screen, we could interact in, you know, a virtual world of some sort.
But to me, I see it the exact opposite. Somebody could go out and my digital twin could go out and create a murder and come back and be me, and then I'm facing time for a murder. And I realize this is in the digital world, but think about that, you know, I mean, like, and it probably will grow out of that, just in that space, so that you can create a digital twin that you can go out into the world and beat, right? So I have been arguing for years against people using social security numbers. Social security numbers were not intended for their use now. And every entity, whether it's financial, educational, whatever it is, wants to know your social security number. And so those places have been hacked. They are breaches. And you know, so to me, if you're going to create a digital twin, it should be in that space, right? So you're looking at Social Security or whatever this number is that links somebody to something. So I'm identified by my social security number to a lot of people. That's how they know me, just by these numbers, right? So things like blockchain and other things might come in and fix that. But to think about blockchain marrying digital twin might be a way to secure people's identities. Although I don't see anybody interested in doing that, because there's got to be some money in both ways, right? So what is the benefit of me helping you with this place where I might be able to make money off of you?
Yeah. And there's like, I mean, there's not a lot of like monetary advantage to that, like, unfortunately. So that'll probably be, it probably won't happen anytime soon.
Exactly. Scary world, Drew. Scary world.
Well, on that positive note, I think we'll wrap up. But thank you, everybody, for listening. Please send us emails to imminentteachnology@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you, and we will see you all next week.